Welcome, everyone. How's everyone doing? Wide awake, bushy-tailed? It's Saturday afternoon of General Assembly. Woohoo! So, welcome to an ongoing conversation which we would love to engage you. We're here to talk about what we like to call in Boston a wicked problem. It's also the language of adaptive leadership, and what that means is it's a problem that can't be solved with mere technical solutions alone. It's something where we have to use all of our creative energy and try some things and fail. And so we need all of you to be participants with us in looking for a future where we can be economically sustainable. My name is Sarah Lammert. I serve our denomination as the Director of Ministries and Faith Development. Basically, we started this conversation because I and my colleagues in ministries were starting to feel like maybe we were the only ones staying up late at night worrying about the increasing student loan debt, the worry that congregations were struggling with their pledge drives and struggling to manage being just compensation employers and also fair compensation givers, fair share givers to the UUA, plus funding all the wonderful ministry that they want to do in the world. And those two just together create an interesting issue for people who are coming out looking for good jobs, and maybe there are less and less full-time, well-funded jobs to find. So we wanted to expand the group of people who were taking ownership of this issue. And really, my thinking came to a culmination when I was invited to be a guest speaker, along with Jim Keyes, actually, our moderator, for a class that was being held by both Harvard Seminary and Starr King School for the Ministry online. So they had students from both schools. It was a course on entrepreneurial ministry. And when I met with these students, they had incredibly wonderful visions of new and creative forms that ministry could take out in the world. And really, they were selling a vision that I wanted to buy. But when I asked the question of what is your business model for your new ministry, many of them told me they were planning not to earn at all, and that they might have, at most, a year or two before their student loans kicked in and before they had to start earning a real living. Am I getting a little feedback here? I'll try standing a little further back. Is that better? Can you still hear me? Okay, good. So I would like to see our creative ministries and ministers supported in the work they're doing by a larger group than the seminarians alone trying to figure this out on their own. The UUA, of course, is willing to partner, but we don't have all the resources we would need either to launch some kind of an entrepreneurial venture capital fund. I know that some of our candidates, some of you were just at the candidate forum and you heard some creative ideas around that, but it's going to take us all to figure it out. So just a quick overview. We've actually began this conversation on what is called the Panel on Theological Education in 2014. That is a group that oversees a $9 million endowment at the Unitarian Universalist Association that's meant to support theological education. We support things like advanced scholarship for people doing dissertation work around issues of faith and religion in society. And they also give substantial grants to our two identity-based seminaries, Starr King School and Meadville Lombard. That's, in fact, where the majority of the funds go. We had a summit in 2015 in St. Louis that brought together about 60 leaders and also ministers representing all different walks and stages of ministry and different economic circumstances to talk about the problem. And then this last year, we had a follow-up meeting with a smaller group that I would really categorize as a consultation around two main topics. One, how can we break through around doing a better job of educating our people about money and applying that to our values in the world from cradle till death. So also equipping our ministers better, to those who are in the parish, to actually lead a small business, which a lot of us are not trained to do, and to be more confident as fundraisers. So that was the focus of one of the conversations. And the other was around unleashing the power of lay ministry, because it looks like the economic model we have of credentialing ministers may not last forever into the future. We hope that it's a both and, but we would also like to empower lay ministers to lead without having to go through the entire process of going to seminary. Let me just give you a few facts. All right, I can do it this way. Since 2007, 19 million American adults have joined the ranks of the religiously unaffiliated. And as much as we would like to capture those spiritual but not religious, I haven't seen any denomination succeed in doing that. Religiously unaffiliated Americans may be a slightly higher percentage in the millennials, the younger and the older millennials, and you'll see the breakout there. But it's actually a phenomenon that's happening across generational categories. And I think sometimes we have a myth that it's just young adults that are leaving structured religion, but it's really even the silent generation you can see there. Meanwhile, charitable giving in the United States has shifted dramatically since 1956. And you can see there in 1956, religious groups received more than 50% of all charitable giving in the United States. Most of that did not go to institutions like the UUA. It went to local congregations. And look at the drop by 2014, 30% going to religious organizations. That is a significant difference in the piece of the pie. Meanwhile, charitable giving has remained fairly steady overall. And where is the wealth? I wanted to just look beyond a little bit beyond the religious sphere. In 1982, Forbes identified only 13 billionaires in the world. In 2015, in order to make the top 400, you would have to have more than $1.55 billion. That's sobering, isn't it? The top 190th wealthiest individuals owned half of all global wealth. And white Americans own 13 times the holdings of black Americans. So back in our little corner of the universe, what do we have to do on Sundays besides go to a religious church? Back then, it might be choosing between two different houses of worship. Now, look at all the choices we have. You might want to go outside to the park, your kid's soccer team. You might want to sit home and read the paper and have a cup of coffee or catch up on Facebook. But then there are also new forms of gathering that are popping up, and I've just given you two examples here. One is SoulCycle, which is a huge phenomenon out there. Some of you SoulCyclers, it's where you can go get your religious and your exercise needs met all in an hour. You can go and sit on the bike, and there is a leader who will take you through literally a very meaningful spiritual process. And in fact, during a part of the time that you're there, they turn the lights out completely, and people have a very cathartic experience. Another example is Pop-Up Shabbat, which started in New York but is taking off across the country. It's where mostly young adults are offering online that they're going to have a host of pop-up Shabbat dinner on Friday night, and they invite people to come and join. And it happens in small groups all over the country. There's also the dinner party. I could name dozens of these new ways. The dinner party being another young adult thing for 20s and 30s who have experienced a significant loss in their life. And people just announce they're having a dinner. People get together, they bring potluck items, and they talk about these deep issues. Meanwhile, for people who are picking the traditional ministry path, seminary debt is growing. When I was in seminary back a little while ago, and that was in 1990 to 1993, it cost me exactly $15,000 for 3 years of tuition. That's just not the case today. In 2015, 83 recipients of our UUA loan forgiveness grants received a total of $52,000, roughly, but their total seminary debt for those 83 individuals equaled $3.8 million. That's just not enough that we're doing to help our seminarians thrive when they get out of school. And you can see the range of indebtedness. I think the average is around $40,000 to $46,000, something like that. Okay, so that's just a little bit of background. And I'm going to invite Tom Shade up to take the next section of this conversation.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Shade, and I write a blog, and they asked me to come to these conferences because I have written some about this issue, and I have no institutional role, so I get to say whatever I want. And these good people trust me. First off, I think we should just make a little distinction. There is the question of the economic sustainability of ministry, a profession, it's my profession, and the economic sustainability of the ministries of Unitarian Universalism. And these two are, in some sense, the same problem. And we have to recognize that, in some sense, they're in contradiction with each other. Anybody who has looked at trying to build the programs out in your local church knows that your professional salaries are, in fact, coming out of the same pot as your ministries, and that if you lean too far in one way, you may end up shorting the other. They're in contradiction with each other. Second point I want to make. This is my observation after being around Unitarian Universalism my entire life, is there's an incredibly powerful sense of entitlement about money all through Unitarian Universalism. We have been so generously blessed by endowments, by the Veach Fund, by the thing, that we have no idea exactly where we are in the world of what the relationship is between the money that we give to our local congregation, which filters up to the UUA, and what we see and what we get. We aren't aware of all the grants for the fund for the universe, you know, for Unitarian Universalism, all that's built into all of these things that we do here. We are not living in an immediately transparent relationship with how much it costs to be Unitarian Universalist. This is true in local congregations too, except in all perhaps the smallest and most struggling ones. I served a church in Worcester which had a very generous endowment. People just assumed that any time someone sat down to play a piano in the church service, it would be a Steinway. The piano player would be professionally trained, and the piano would have been recently tuned. Nobody thought about what goes into making that possible. And that entitlement also goes into the professional ministry. One of the great conundrums that I have not yet sorted out after 15 years in the ministry is the powerful sense of it, of overlapping entitlement and resentment that is surrounding the professional ministry, which I think comes up in innumerable ways. The other thing that we don't expect is that we are not aware of we assume that our religious life will actually have a minimal financial impact on our personal lives. That we will sustain our congregation with pledges, and that we'll still live the lives that we want to live. And people talk about, they can't make their pledge because they're making another. It would mean losing their vacation that year. We are expected to have a religious life that has a very small impact on our personal financial lives. My third point, beyond all that entitlement question, which I think all of us need to examine, is as we look at this question, it is not that the money is misallocated. You can do a little exercise where you say, well, student loan debt. So who should help them? Well, maybe the congregation should pay them more so they can pay off their student loan debt. But of course, the congregation is having trouble reaching their budget. And so, well, maybe the UUA could help the congregation. But the UUA doesn't have the money either because the congregations aren't fully funding the APF. Well, you know, you can chase the need for the money around the system, and eventually you figure out that it's not like the money's in the wrong pocket. There's just not enough. And so you need to have a much bigger view of the situation. I'm sure everybody in this room has heard Bernie Sanders' campaign speech, so I don't think I have to describe to you the plight of the middle class. We are well acquainted with all of the stats that he has repeated over and over again for the last few years. That's the backdrop of it. The middle class, which supports our congregations, is at a flat economic roll, and so naturally our congregations are as well. So we have to imagine an entirely different relationship between money and organized religion and faith. And because of the fact that we have this powerful sense of entitlement about money and faith and religion in our culture, it is on the one hand, we are seeing it first, the need, and it hurts, it pinches us more, and it also gives us which makes us blind to it, and defensive, it also gives us an opportunity to work to change it. So we're going to have to do more with less. And we're going to have to be more ministry with less resources behind it. More cooperative work, less professionalism, more layers of religious leadership, professional and semi-professional and lay leadership. We're going to have to acknowledge our vulnerability in the economic circumstance. We're going to have to share the vulnerability of the people we serve. That was one of the things we never quite did in the church I served. We always presented ourselves as though we had everything pretty much together. And we didn't share that vulnerability. And we need more generosity to pay for essential work. And we have to recognize the fact that if we intend to conduct the kind of ministries, the kind of transformative ministries that we want to in the world, that it's going to mean actual sacrifices and changes in our personal circumstances. So now that's the big picture. And as you discuss this issue, this is what we have found, that you start with a small problem, you can build it into the whole Megillah. And then when you look at that, at the whole Megillah, you go, what the hell can we do about it? So let's go back and at least try to solve one or two problems and try to make some actual steps forward. So this because it's what we call the wicked problem, it has both macro level and micro level kind of thinking and solutions on it. So at the economic summit we did in St. Louis, we got really big picture. Really big picture after a while. And then when we met again to follow up, we focused in on just kind of two, what can we do about this now? And one of those was, how do we deal with lay ministry? The problem always with lay ministry has been who trains, who certifies, who does that? And we concluded that we were not at a place that we could actually imagine a single entity that would do that. But we needed to share practices across the various groups and organizations and schools that are training lay ministries to start to develop common practices and best practices about training and supporting and holding accountable lay ministers in their work. And we also talked about generosity and education around generosity and finances and money. So we're throwing around OWL for money, you know, and to kind of catch up, you know, they used to say we never talked about sex or money in church, and we kind of got over the sex thing, but now, now it's time to push forward and actually talk about money at church. Who's next up here? Carrie, I think.
How's that? Is that better? So the first, the summit that I attended in St. Louis, and sorry, to introduce myself, I'm Carrie McDonald. I'm the Director of Outreach for the Unitarian Universalist Association. I am not a minister, although I did previously sit as a lay member of the Ministerial Fellowship Committee, so I know the inside of the process pretty well, and just how much training and certification we put our professional ministers through. It really is a remarkable process that does a good job of producing competent ministers for parish ministry. And of course, the problem is that that reality is also changing right under our feet. So when we went to the summit in St. Louis, one of the cool things that I saw is that for the first time that I'd observed all of the lead institutional actors in a room. So the UUA leadership, right? The president, the senior staff, the UUA board of trustees, members, the moderator, the presidents of the seminaries, the chair of the MFC, representatives from all the professional organizations, the Ministers Association, the Liberal Religious Educators Association, etc. They all got in the room together and all understood that it was no one's fault that we are here, that it is not a matter of just pointing fingers and allocating blame. As Tom said, there's just not enough money to chase in our system in the way that we have come to expect for there to be. And that was a really powerful moment to see all of those leaders understand that we're in this together and that there's no one group that can fix this on their own. So I just want to hold that up because this has been a very institutional conversation driven by, convened by the strongest organizations within Unitarian Universalism because we have a stake in this. However, as we talk about wicked, complex, knotted problems that are difficult to untangle, it's sometimes helpful to start from a different place and that we can talk ourselves into circles of anxiety if we're concerned more with the institutional viability or sustainability than we are about the reality of that's experienced by the people that are leading our faith day in and day out in our congregations, in our communities. So for the meeting that was in Boston this year, we said, let's try a different perspective. So what we wanted to do with you today is give you a taste of that and let you do that a little bit on your own and tell us some of the realities that you experience through our use of personas, which I'll explain in a minute. So we used a process called design thinking. When I say design thinking, does that sound familiar to anybody? A couple of hands, yeah? It's a buzzword these days. And design thinking is a way of understanding how to solve a problem that starts in a very different place from where we typically start. As folks who run organizations, typically start with our outcome that we'd like to define, and then we develop a strategic plan to get to the outcome, and then we think of the steps of the plan, and then we go ahead and implement them, hopefully. Hopefully our plan isn't out of date the moment it, hits the paper. And design thinking instead, which comes out of the world of technology and of, artistic design, starts at a different place, and you can't see this as well on this slide, but I'll narrate this for you. It starts with empathy. It starts with first understanding not just the problem, but the people that are experiencing that problem and what their life is like. And that you have to spend some time building empathy and understanding in order to... Thank you. Did that help? Maybe? Maybe not. You have to find some you have to spend some time building empathy and understanding way before you can start jumping to solutions to problems. Then you have to define problems and opportunities that the folks who you are trying to help are experiencing. Then you can brainstorm. You want to try this one? I can unplug it. How's this one? Better? Okay. So, we're talking about design thinking. You have to start with empathy. Then you can define the challenge that you're trying to address from the perspective of the people that you are trying to serve. Then you brainstorm all kinds of different things, get out of your comfort zone, try new ideas. And then before you even test, you want to make sure you get some feedback on that brainstorm. This diagram uses the word prototype. And then finally, you test ideas. Rather than putting a 3 to 5 year strategic plan in place, you start with ideas and options that you get into the field as quick as you can so that you can get feedback on what gets traction and what falls flat. So in some ways, this just sounds like, yeah, it's continuous improvement. Yeah, we've heard that before. That's just good practice. But I think if you do it right, you have a whole different emotional experience of connection with the people with whom you're trying to work that makes new kinds of solutions to complex problems possible. Just a couple words about empathy. We use a tool called Personas in which we attach a face and a name to the people who are experiencing the problems that we want to speak to. And personas are not pulled out of thin air. They are based on data and analysis and demographics and commonalities. And so we then, you know, put some flesh on the bones with some stories about them. But the important thing is that they represent the core, the center, the heart of the constituencies you're working with. And then, you know, we can immerse them in ourselves in that person's reality, and ultimately you can define the opportunity to help them. That's what you're trying to do. So today, we're going to put on our empathy goggles a little bit. Let's put them on. I really wish I knew what these were for. Like, I found this picture, but I don't know. Like, space goggles from 1955, I would love to know. So I'd like to introduce you to the two personas that we used for our discussions at the meeting this spring in Boston. And I'm going to introduce them to you, but let me just tell you that they share there's some similarities between them. And while we want to be aspirational, we also base this on who currently pursues leadership in Unitarian Universalism. So did you know that 60% of our clergy are female? Did you realize that those are similar statistics among our youth and young adult leaders as well, that gender breakdown? I think most of us know that racially we're a majority white denomination, and I don't say that to marginalize the experience of people of color like me. I say that because substantially these are the folks. This is who's at the center of our leadership work. And there is other work that it takes to change that. But we wanted to at least start by understanding where the center of that currently resides. So the first person I want to introduce you to is Allie. Allie is, these are the demographics that we use to put Allie's persona together. She's a female aged 18 to 25. She's got at least one marginalized identity that is a barrier to her connecting with the cultural center of Unitarian Universalism. She's out of high school, working at or in school. She has some geographic mobility. She has had UU leadership experiences, pretty extensive ones, in her congregation and beyond. She's very interested in social justice, but is not someone who has a very clear career path. She's not going to be a neurosurgeon necessarily, right? She's open to a lot of possibilities. And she really feels dedicated to Unitarian Universalism. So I will tell you Allie's story here that we wrote for her. Allie loves Unitarian Universalism. Ever since she took Our Whole Lives and Coming of Age, she's been a leader among her peers and in her congregation. Allie identifies as bi queer, and her church was a huge support for her when she came out. She was president of her youth group and the youth group representative on the Religious Education Council and attended General Assembly as a delegate her senior year. When she left for college, she started a small meeting group of UU students, and drawing on her experience of starting a gay-straight alliance at her high school, helped the group partner with the Take Back the Night chapter to fight sexual violence on campus. Now that she's graduated from college, Allie wants to find a way to stay connected to Unitarian Universalism in a new city where the congregation doesn't have many people between high school age and mid-40s.
She's interested in public health. She interned with Planned Parenthood in college, feels passionately about reproductive justice as a core calling of her faith. People have told her over the years that she should become a minister, but she's not sure she wants to go to grad school and would have to take on a lot of debt on top of her college loans. If she takes on that amount of debt, she's more inclined to pursue a flexible degree like a master's in social work or a master's in public health. She has a friend from youth group who's a member of his district board and encouraged her to think about volunteering on a committee, but she hears districts are changing. Today, while working part-time, Allie wonders how her faith can help her through the coming transitions in her life. Has anybody met somebody like Allie? I feel like I know a lot of Allies. And we use personas also because we don't want to make assumptions about a single person's experience, right? If Allie were a real person, then those particularities would be so specific to her experience, and it wouldn't be fair of us to understand. But by putting a persona together, it can help us build empathy with folks who share pieces of Allie's experience. So Allie here feels deeply connected to Unitarian Universalism, unsure how she's going to stay connected because she works on Sunday mornings. She wants to have a meaningful career, but got to pay those bills, and the loans definitely don't pay themselves. Work-life balance is a struggle, as it is for many of us, because she's starting out in a new city. And she's really happy to volunteer, but she wants to live an embodied faith and be seen as a leader not right now, not in 5 to 10 years, if she goes to enough leadership development trainings. So that's Allie. Now I want to introduce you to Karen, who is a white female, ages 55 to 65. She works in health, human services, education, one of the human services sectors, nearing retirement. She's been partnered, maybe she's still partnered, has adult children, owns her home, volunteers a lot in the community. She cares immensely about social issues, and she's been a longtime leader in her congregation, say maybe 25 years she's been a member. She wants to go further as a UU leader and deepen her spirituality in this stage, this upcoming next stage of her life. Would you like to hear Karen's story? We had some fun with these. When Karen shared her journey of faith testimony last Sunday morning, she couldn't believe it had been 25 years since she joined First Church. She felt like it was only yesterday that she and her husband were new to the area and looking for a faith community to raise their kids. Since then, she's been a member of 4 different committees, including a term as chair of the board. Karen sings in the choir, helps start her congregation's small group ministry program, and now acts as a worship associate. She met her closest friends through her congregation while they watched their children go through the religious education programs together. Karen's a year from retirement at her job as a mental health manager for the county and is considering what she wants to do next. She's growing increasingly concerned about the racial disparities in her city and wants to get better connected with those efforts, even though she might not know how. Karen's also been working on her yoga practice, including attending a 5-day retreat, and wants to focus on her inner life with the time she'll have in retirement. She's looked into seminary because she feels like it would be the next logical step for her path of religious leadership, and she knows it could expose her to a whole different sense of spirituality and connection. However, she's so invested in her community that she can't imagine moving across the country for school, an internship, or a ministerial settlement, and doesn't think her retirement savings will cover tuition. She's more interested in something like chaplaincy at a local hospital. The church has meant so much to Karen over the course of her life, and she wants to see that it continues for the next generation. She hopes she can be a part of that transition in this, the next phase of her life. So her goals and challenges: she's called to serve her congregation and her community, feeling deeply connected. She's seeking personal spiritual fulfillment in the next stage because she's done everything there is to do in her congregation. And she's changing to a different phase of life, which is including new health and financial concerns for her, and that all feels daunting. So these are our 2 folks who might be considering Unitarian Universalist ordained ministry. And these are 2 folks who are grappling with the reality of change, of the decline of the middle class in this country, of the changing nature of family and school and housing that makes it tough to succeed in the way that maybe previous generations did. And so what we want to understand is, how can we create a system or help create a system of leadership and empowerment that reflects their reality? That's the place where we'd like to start. So we'd like you to help us with that. by doing a little bit of discussion with the folks near you. Would you do that with me, please? You don't have a choice. Thank you very much. So I want you to spend about 5 minutes and get into a group of maybe 3 or 4 people, and I want you to pick either Allie or Karen, and I want you to spend just a little bit of time getting to know them. Can you do that? So we have a couple of prompting questions for you, but you can talk about whatever you want. You could imagine a week in their life. Where do they go? Who do they talk to? That's both virtually and in person. You could write down 5 things they need in their life right now and 5 gifts that they have. You could imagine some of the times that maybe they felt most connected to this faith, or some of the times when it might have been challenging, and think about what those experiences were like. So spend about 5 or 10 minutes talking with someone near you. Pick Allie or Karen. Tell me if you want to go back to one of the slides. And just get to know them a little bit, and then we're going to ask a question about how we could support their leadership in ministry, okay? So take another 2 minutes to, get to know your persona here, and then I've got a question that I want you to think about. Okay. I'm going to ask you to find a cadence. Take a break. So, okay. Who talked about Karen? Group talked about Karen? Tell me some of the things that you learned by trying to understand Karen a little more. What did you learn? Give me one thing that you talked about with Karen.
Oh, what did you learn with Karen? She's looking toward how she is still going to be of use, but of what's going to be fulfilling to her. She doesn't want to do just anything. She wants to do something meaningful.
Thank you. Who else had Karen? Yes.
We thought that she was really seeking a deeper spiritual experience through her consideration of ministry. But it needed to be local.
But it's got to be local, not traveling across the country. Who else? Talked about Karen? You got nominated.
Just one of the things you talked about with Karen.
We feel like she needs a full evaluation of her health and financial situation before she can make a recent decision.
So needing to pay attention to those health and financial considerations. How about folks who, do you, something else you want to say about Karen?
I was reminded of the challenge of how to help somebody go deeper without having to go to seminary.
Is there anybody who's named Karen in the room? How about Allie? Okay, good, because otherwise I can imagine this could be a little bit weird for you. But okay, who talked about Allie? I'll start over here. Tell me something that you talked about with Allie.
Some of the things that we talked about with Allie was that she might be experiencing some... having to start over in a new community if she was in college, and she'd be frustrated with the types of worship that were there and maybe not feel like it was where she needed to be and what she was looking for to extend her spiritual experience and being marginalized by her community.
Who else? Who has something they'd like to share about Allie? I'm coming over here.
Hi, we talked about her gifts, and we imagined that her UU history would be a gift that she would be bringing forward, and that she might have some flexibility in her schedule as a single person, maybe. We thought that she may be an enthusiastic and have some energy and passion to bring forward and has experience in UU leadership.
Thanks. And I hope that there is a UU congregation there, because otherwise I think she would probably have a really sense of loss and a need to be able to bring those gifts somewhere, and some group is going to get them.
If it's not us, someone will. Who else talked about Allie? Folks back here? I know some folks over here did. to talk about, Allie? Yeah, sure. Anything you want to share?
I know with Allie, we kind of talked about some of the challenges she was facing, particularly being young. She probably doesn't have a lot of money, so that's probably kind of a big hurdle for getting, like, going to the seminary route or even going for continuing training, even as a lay leader. That was kind of the big thing that kind of came out, was the financial challenges, really, for both Karen and Allie, just different scenarios.
Any other folks over here, anything else you want to add? Yes.
I didn't hear about her, but what I was told was that she was interested in having some impact now, so we thought maybe some sort of a mentoring situation, maybe go to a youth church and work with youth professionals, working with youth, so that she could learn the route and have some learn some leadership and have an opportunity to make a difference.
Along those lines, one of our other group members talked about maybe having her partner with a community minister and talked about the opportunities that might provide and also how that schedule might be a bit different. We understood she wasn't free on Sunday mornings for sort of traditional. And then maybe I'll just throw this out there that I wondered aloud with the group about something like sanctuaries in D.C., which I have this really vague and probably wrong idea that it's a group of people that gets together to be creative together, and I imagine that it's creative leaders that do things that stir their souls and move their hearts and perhaps involve social justice, but it's not like quote-unquote regular Sunday church.
Thank you all. Are you all, is anyone else familiar with the sanctuaries that Linda mentioned? This is a group started by Unitarian Universalists in Washington, D.C., that is a soulful and creative arts community. And they do a lot of really cool stuff. They even have an album out. Look them up at thesanctuaries.org. So the question that I have for you that I would like you to also discuss with your groups is, what would make Allie or Karen want to become a spiritual leader? What would make them want to invest in their own spiritual deepening and skill building? What would make that possible? What would discourage that? What would it feel like to have a system of ministry training and investment that would work for Karen or for Allie? Does that make sense? Right? We're trying to understand how we can imagine a leadership pipeline or system or ideas that work for the reality that we have today as represented by Karen and Allie. Does that make sense? Okay. So take another 5 minutes and talk with your group again and see what kind of ideas you have, and then I'll ask you to share some of the thoughts that come out of that discussion. Okay. You all ready to come back? You all ready to come back? No one's shouting at me. Please, 10 more seconds. Okay, so for this part, I'm going to ask you about some areas, and then you can just call out if you talked about this and what you talked about, and I'll repeat it back to the mic so everybody can hear. So who talked about education and training opportunities? Anybody talk about that? What did you talk about?
Barriers to formal professional education.
Working with mentors. So more informal kinds of training opportunities rather than formal educational opportunities. Okay, great. Who else?
We talked about attending a leadership school for a week to work on discernment as whether or not this really was a path.
So attending leadership schools, which exist in all parts of the UUA, but some to specifically help with discernment and career planning. I like that. What else? Who else talked about training and education? Online classes? That's great. Active support from your congregation and your minister, if you have a minister, as empowering you to raise you up. I really like that. Also, on online classes, I hope you all know that the Central East Region offers the UU Leadership Institute, which is all online. Classes are like $30. They're 8 weeks. Check it out at uuinstitute.org. But there's so much more we could do there. Yes, in the back.
So low-cost, time-limited, clear opportunities for leadership development and spiritual deepening, like a camp or so. Who talked about travel or experiencing other communities and opportunities? Anybody talk about that? Yep.
We talked about that being a barrier for Karen.
So travel's a real barrier can be a barrier for Karen, so we need to be mindful of that. What else? Yes?
Criticality of clusters.
The importance of clusters, right? And when we say clusters, we mean other UU groups and congregations that are as physically close by as possible, which is easier in the suburbs of Boston than it is in Spokane, right? We know that. But getting in touch with that community of UUs that's around you. Yes?
Doing UU volunteer work at a level outside of just your church.
Doing UU... So doing volunteer work also at a level outside your church. What did you talk about in terms of personal spiritual exploration and deepening or theology or religious study? Anybody talk about that? Oh, well, maybe that's good. Yes, what? What'd you say? So we want to find the people who have hit the plateau of leadership and find a way to give them a next step, a next level up. In ways that make sense for them. Yes. So thinking about online and distance learning, maybe you can get some information, but there's something special about being a part of that cohort that you get in seminary about being physically near and sharing space and meals with other people who are going through the same experience.
We found it difficult
when
people engineered our car, and I find ministry much more complicated.
Yes. Ministry sometimes more complicated than cars. Yes. Agree. Absolutely agree. Yes, Richard. So Karen, definitely somebody who's done a lot to serve her community and has tried to do whatever has been called of and asked for, and she really needs an opportunity to do more that is not just institutional maintenance, but is really speaking to her deeper needs. Yes, that was great. Was there another one back here? Yes.
Wellspring.
So Wellspring, do you want to say something more about what Wellspring is for those who haven't heard of it? So Wellspring, spiritual mentoring, spiritual practices, spiritual deepening, spiritual companionship. Sometimes I've heard it referred to as coming of age for adults, in that it's a structured program that goes deeper. So one of the things that was really important that we noted during our conversation about unleashing the power of lay ministry was that there's actually quite a lot of wonderful formational activities and opportunities happening right now. Wellspring is a great example. The Central East Region, or the Ohio Meadville District, where we are, has had a commissioned lay leaders, lay ministers program since the 70s. And they look different. But that they don't share the same sense of mutual respect across the association. They're very localized or particularized. And that realization was one of the core pieces to the idea that Tom mentioned, which was how can we just at least start to unleash the power of lay ministry by building up those connections and shared understandings between those existing programs and folks who are working on that. Yes, in the back. So question about, do we assume that lay ministers are volunteers or paid leaders? When I use the term lay, I simply mean people who are not ordained. But did anyone talk about compensation? Did anybody talk about that? Yes, what did you say? So the reality is that it's hard to find full-time jobs, and the kinds of professional opportunities that might come out of these kinds of trainings for either Karen or Allie are part-time, you know, a couple hours a week, no benefits. That's what we're seeing right now. Yeah, absolutely. Anybody else talk about compensation? Yes? So, sorry, just to recap, noting that there's actually a large number of congregational presidents, right, all the way in. You're all in if you're a congregational president, who are no longer in the faith because presumably volunteer burnout, right, and there wasn't this next level of respect and understanding. And I'm sure some of those folks went to seminary, and some of those folks probably couldn't find the right pathway for them. Yeah, was there something else you wanted to add? Thank you. So that's a nice way to put it is we have a lot of 100-level courses, but we could use some 200, 300, and 600-level courses as well.
I'm actually going to end our conversation there about this, but thank you very much. Please give yourselves a hand for this. This is, you know, it's a stretch to do this kind of work, and I think you all made some really excellent points. And so I hope that as you think about these questions going forward about what it takes to sustain the economic reality of ministry, that you can use these as inspiration and possibilities to guide what you think may be possible. So we're going to turn it over to Tom to do a little bit of general Q&A with the time we have left.
Well, we got 5 minutes left.
Make it quick.
So if anybody has a question or a comment, I know there's a huge amount of stuff, but please, short.
This goes back to what discourages them. Is there any possibility that the requirements of an MDiv will be changing to actually meet the needs of what the world needs and what you need as a spiritual person? Specifically to what you ministers are doing, why do we have to continue to take so many levels of Old Testament readings and need to learn Hebrew and these things? Like, why are we wasting our time doing some of this stuff? It's good to have some basics to be able to do.
Well, I love my MDiv, and I didn't consider it, but I think you have asked the $64,000 question in this whole thing. Is are our requirements for fellowshipping, which includes the MDiv, the internship, the psychological or career assessment, the CPE experience, do they are they economically too burdensome in the terms of the amount of time that they ask for, the amount that they cost, and do they match up with what people really want to do and need in ministry? How do we resolve that problem? And that is the $64,000 question of what is in this whole question. It's even more than $64,000 question at this point. It's probably about $80,000 question, so or $100,000. So I think, I mean, I don't know the answer to that question, but I think you're on to the exact kind of the nub. What?
There's conversations.
Of course, of course, of course, of course. Yes. What's your name then? Quick.
Hi, I'm
Sarah Jo.
Sarah Jo. Sarah Jo Fridley from First Church New Orleans.
Okay. Write that name down. All right.
I would add that some of that conversation is happening at each theological school because it's very different from one to another what the requirements are.
Yeah. Yes, yes, that's true. That's another question, comment, way back there. One each in Meadville Lombard. Other comments? I'll have the mic here in case people. Comments, questions? Yes, sir.
Our minister was telling us the other night that the requirements or the process for fellowshipping has changed and that it's much more uncertain as the seminarian moves to completion and actually goes to fellowship, and it's an all or nothing decision at that point, and there isn't any, you know, there isn't any sort of interim steps or there isn't a mentoring or something that gets you to a point where if you don't match up at the end, you know, you don't have any recourse. I think that's a real difficulty.
Yeah, I think it's a fairly complicated system, and there is at a certain point a kind of cutoff point, but there are some, let's call them, places where you can be conditionally granted fellowship or places where you're given specific direction where to go next to get fellowship. So it's not quite as harsh as perhaps you heard that.
I think what he may be talking about
Sarah
is that the
know.
Regional subcommittees, which were a midway formation feedback system, were eliminated, but we're actually replacing that with a more comprehensive in-care formational support network that we're working on with the UU Ministers Association. So that's in process. Our time has come to a close, so I just want to end with a comment that we got from one of our younger ministers at the original summit in St. Louis. After much gnashing of teeth and worrying about all the issues, she stood up. This was Robin Tanner. Some of you know her, Force of Nature, just about to move to Summit, New Jersey in the winter. But she stood up and said, you know, for my generation, and I think, Carrie, you shared this sentiment too, the sky isn't falling, it's opening up. And I would invite us to take this opportunity of this, you know, crisis has two sides. One is difficulty and one is opportunity. And certainly change is involved there. But I just encourage you to take that thought with you out the door. What new possibilities could emerge? What could we open up and for Allie, for Karen, for many others, in terms of having a more engaged, sustained relationship with their faith that looks different than the pathways we have now? So much possibility awaits. And thank you for being with us today.